Is this too loud or it's fine? Okay. First of all, just a couple of quick announcements. There are multiple cameras and several press agencies here present that will be filming this. We just thought we would inform the crowd. Secondly, we have ample time for questions and answers, so we would appreciate if you kept your comments and interruptions till after Professor Finkelstein finishes his speech. Thirdly, we would really appreciate it if everyone turned off their mobile phones, and not just on silent, just turn them off. Okay, when asked to be the person to present Professor Finkelstein today, I have to say I had two main conflicting reactions. On the one hand, I felt, as I still do now, that I felt very worried because there's simply no way for someone like me to be able to do justice with a few words in a few minutes to a person of Professor Finkelstein's caliber. On the other hand, I have to say I felt very relieved because I can be sure that with Professor Finkelstein here, no matter what I say, no one will remember or care to remember, so I can that takes off the stress. So there's been a lot of debate around campus about why we chose to bring Professor Finkelstein, and there have been editorials in the newspaper and many people have talked about it. And I'd just like to first point out that it was a large coalition of several groups who have worked diligently on making this event successful. We actually had 9 groups working on this. It was mainly the Muslim Student Association, along with Safa, Turaf, Qanun, the Arab Student Association, the United Students of Color Council, the Organization of Pakistani Students, the Columbia Student Solidarity Network, and Students Promoting Empowerment and Knowledge. So thank you, everyone. Now, the question is, what is it that brings everyone or all these groups together to co-sponsor this event? And to begin answering the question, I think we have to take a look back at the background of events that have been happening around Columbia over the last couple of years. Anyone who's been around here or has had the chance to read some of the newspapers around New York will no doubt know about what has been happening, and many people will have the impression that Columbia is a bastion of anti-Semitism. It's a place where hardline racist professors conspire to thrust propaganda down their unsuspecting students' throats. And this has been a raging issue over the last couple of years in this university, and I am not going to enter into discussing it in detail, but what this debate and what this talk has led to over the last couple of years is that there's been a large, I beg your pardon, there's been a large chilling effect in Colombia, if we may call it that. Debate of anything pertaining to the Middle East has become a taboo that is better left avoided, equally for students and professors. For almost 2 years now, Colombia has not been debating the Middle East. Unfortunately, we have only been debating whether it is okay to debate the Middle East or not. So we think the stifling of this debate is something very worrying. It is very worrying from an academic point of view. This is one of the most reputable universities in America and around the world. And this university, like other universities, should always be the place where free ideas are debated and people engage in critical thinking for the public good. This is also worrying from a moral perspective. There are many pressing issues in the world, and it is just wrong to leave many of those issues outspoken and not debated. A taboo of silence is a very worrying thing in the face of one of the most crucial issues of our day, especially in a place like Columbia University. We are all groups who believe strongly in academic freedom, and we believe in the need to debate all ideas and in the need to talk particularly about the controversial issues of the day, because these are issues of significant importance for us and for a lot of people around the world. And it was out of this concern, our desire to bring Professor Finkelstein arose. He is a scholar who has published several works of immense importance on many of the issues we are concerned with. In 1996, he wrote The Rise and Fall of Palestine, a personal account of the Intifada years, which was translated into 2 other languages. In 1998, he wrote A Nation on Trial, The Goldhagen Thesis and Historical Truth, which was named a notable book of 1998 by the New York Times Sunday Book Review. It has been translated into 3 foreign languages so far. In 1995, he wrote Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, and it has been translated into 5 languages. The Holocaust Industry, Reflection on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, was written in 1995. It has been an international bestseller, and it has been translated into 18 foreign languages. And finally, most recently, a few months ago, Professor Finkelstein released Beyond Chutzpah on the misuse of antisemitism and the abuse of history. Professor Finkelstein has spoken extensively about the Middle East throughout his career, and most particularly about the importance of debating the actual conflict and the actual facts on the ground, particularly about the importance of not getting driven away from this conflict into discussing side issues. It is particularly important to engage the issue at hand, as Professor Finkelstein says, because of the great tendency, and I quote, to contrive controversy over the issue when there is a consensus among historians and human rights organizations on the factual record. It is out of our belief in the importance of this debate, out of our belief in the importance of freedom of speech, and out of our belief in the importance of expressing opinion on a university campus that we invited Professor Finkelstein. And I would really appreciate it if everyone would join me in welcoming Professor Norman Finkelstein.
Thank you for having me here this evening, and it's always nice to come to Columbia. As a young man, I used to spend a lot of time here. I was always in awe of the Butler Stacks. Now, that was a real university library, not like the hallowed out silliness at NYU, the Bobst Library. Columbia is a real thinking person's library, and I always enjoyed using it, sometimes a little fearful of entering those cavernous halls. I'm worried about what a perverted professor might do there, but otherwise it was a very special occasion whenever I came here to do my studying. And I think if my memory serves, though it's fading now, I spent a good deal of time in the reading room writing my doctoral dissertation. I haven't been here in many years, and I didn't realize I hadn't seen the new student center. It resembles Centre Pompidou in Paris, and I didn't like that, and I don't like this. I'm more old-fashioned and conventional. I want to thank everybody who organized for this evening, and I'm grateful to them, and I recognize I'm in a privileged position next to them, namely, first of all, because I just fly in and fly out, and they have to endure the flak afterwards. And in addition, it's just not so easy for Muslims, Arabs, and so forth to be organizing around this issue on this campus. So I'm grateful to them. I defer to their courage and integrity, and a special thank you to Saqib Khan, who had to bear, among other things, with my wrath on too many occasions. So a thank you and an apology. The topic I'm going to talk about this evening, just one moment, okay, I want to make sure there's water here. The topic I'm going to talk about this evening is a paradox, I think, in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Namely, if you look at the historical record on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the past, if you look at the current record, the present record, which is basically constituted by the human rights record, Or if you look at the future, basically the diplomatic record, how to resolve the conflict. If you look at those three records, the historical record, the human rights record, the diplomatic record, if you look at those three records, it's remarkably free of controversy on all three levels, on all three dimensions. There is a remarkable, a broad consensus on what happened, what's happening now, and how to resolve the conflict in the future. Nonetheless, if you enter the public arena, a huge amount of controversy swirls around the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the question then arises, how do you account for so much controversy swirling around a conflict which, if you look at the actual record, is remarkably uncontroversial? And the argument I'm going to make this evening is that the vast amount, the vast preponderance of controversy that swirls around the conflict is actually contrived. It's fabricated. It's artificial. And the purpose of this contrived, fabricated controversy is to sow confusion about what the real record is and to distract attention from the actual record. That is, as they used to call it, and you're undergraduates, so you know, that's the thesis statement. And the burden on me this evening is to prove that statement or that claim. I want to begin with a relatively recent example to illustrate the point I just made. In July 2004, the highest judicial body in the world, the World Court, the International Court of Justice, rendered a milestone advisory opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. It focused on the question of the legality of the wall Israel is building in the occupied territory. But as it happened, when it decided to rule on that question or render an advisory opinion, it also rendered an opinion on what turned out to be all the fundamental questions bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Some of you know the terminology of the conflict. It's often referred to as the final status questions, which are said to be the most contentious, the most controversial, the most difficult to resolve. And as I said, for the World Court to render an opinion on the legality of the wall, it had to also rule on all of these fundamental questions about the conflict. For example, the question of borders of the Israeli state and the Palestinian state. The World Court ruled that in accordance with Article 2 of the United Nations Charter and with the fundamental principle of international law, that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war, the World Court ruled that Israel cannot claim an atom, a single atom of sovereignty over the West Bank, Gaza, or Jerusalem. Under international law, the World Court ruled those are, and they used the term over and over again in their opinion, those are occupied Palestinian territories. Thus, contrary to what we're often told in the American media, the U.S. media, the question of borders is not disputed. It is not controversial. The question of borders has been resolved. All the territories Israel occupied in the June 1967 war are occupied Palestinian territories. full stop. Number two, the question of settlements. We're often told the settlements that Israel has built in the occupied territories, they're a controversial question. Not so, says the World Court. Under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it's illegal for an occupying power to transfer its population to occupied territory. Very straightforward. All the settlements that Israel has built in the occupied territories, all 400,000 Jewish settlers are illegally settled or illegally living in Palestinian territory. They constitute, to quote the World Court, a flagrant violation of international law. Number three, I noticed there were several signs that went up, though my vision is dimming. I noticed several signs stating, I love Jerusalem. And of course, no one has the right to deny anyone their affections and loves. But then there is a separate question. That's the question of the law. And the World Court ruled over and over again, if you read the decision, the opinion, the World Court ruled that Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. Israel claims East Jerusalem as part of its eternal and undivided capital. But under international law, it cannot claim even a single atom of sovereignty, legitimate sovereignty, over Jerusalem. And finally, the question of the wall. And the World Court ruled that the wall is illegal under international law, and the international community has an obligation to enforce the advisory opinion. Now, that's only half the story. The other half is the kind of consensus on this advisory opinion. It wasn't a close call. It was not even controversial. The vote on the World Court was 14-1. That's not close. The only dissenting vote was from the American judge, Thomas Bergenthal. Now, the court was anything but a rubber stamp court. Six of the judges in the majority opinion published their own separate opinions, and they registered disagreement with this or that argument in the majority opinion. But on the fundamental questions, borders, settlements, Jerusalem, and the illegality of the wall, there was no dissent. Now, even if you turn to Thomas Bergenthal, it's very interesting to read his opinion. For those of you who applauded it because he dissented, I would say the applause was premature. Because Thomas Bergenthal begins his statement, which he's careful not to call a dissent. He calls it a declaration. And he begins by saying that there is much in the majority opinion with which I agree. And he says at the end of his statement, and it's worth bearing in mind, he says, that if the wall Israel is building is to incorporate the settlements, then it is ipso facto, his term, it is ipso facto illegal, because he says there can be no question those settlements are illegal under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Now, a couple of months ago, Israel's High Court acknowledged that large parts of the wall were being built in order to incorporate the settlements, which means everyone on the world court, including the American judge, agree that at the bare minimum, large segments of the wall are illegal, and there is complete agreement, consensus, that the settlements are illegal. Now that's, I think, a quite revealing conclusion, because we now find that the most authoritative body in the legal body in the world, the World Court, agrees across the board on at least one question, and 14-1 on most questions. They agree on all of the most contentious issues bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that raises, again, the question I want to address this evening. How do you account for all this controversy about a topic which, on its face, is not very controversial at all? I'm going to begin with a brief biographical digression, the relevance of which I hope by the end of this evening will become clear. I first began studying the Israel-Palestine conflict seriously, or first got involved in the issue, in June 1982, at the time of Israel's invasion of Lebanon, about a quarter of a century ago now. I was involved in politics from a quite young age, but not Israel and Palestine, more domestic issues. When the Israeli invasion of Lebanon occurred, I and several other Jews, a handful, formed a little group, had a horrible acronym. It was called JAMAL, Jews Against the Israeli Massacre in Lebanon. There may even be some veterans in the audience. Exercise prudence and don't identify yourself. JAMAL was a catastrophe. I used to say after Sabra and Shatila, it was the second biggest catastrophe of the Lebanon War. Nonetheless, it was intellectually a stimulating environment. And one question that constantly recurred was, are you now or have you ever been? Not are you now or have you ever been a communist, but are you now or have you ever been a Zionist? And I frankly hadn't given much thought to the topic and was unwilling to commit myself. I did believe and still do that politics should be informed by the mind as well as the heart. And since the question kept coming up, I began to read quite extensively on the topic. And after about a year, I decided to turn it into my dissertation topic. I was one of those ABDs, all but dissertation, and this seemed as interesting a subject as any, and I decided to turn it into my dissertation topic. And then about a year later, I basically completed the research phase of my dissertation, and I was about to embark on the writing phase. For those of you who have ever been there, you know that's one of those dreaded moments when you look for every pretext and excuse not to begin writing. There's another book I have to read, or you believe you have to read. And in my case, I didn't need a pretext because, as it were, the pretext came to me. In April 1984, I walked into a bookstore. At that time, it was called the Harper & Row Bookstore. Now it's HarperCollins. I walked into the Harper and Row bookstore, and there prominently placed on the bookshelf was this very hefty volume called From Time Immemorial, The Origins of the Arab-Jewish Conflict Over Palestine. Of course, the title intrigued me, given my dissertation topic. I took it off, and then I did what academics always do. Actually, what academics usually do first is they check the index to see if their name is there. But after that, I turned to the back to see the endorsements. And it was a very impressive list of endorsements. It was practically a who's who of American arts and letters. At the top was Barbara Tuchman, the famed historian of the Guns of August. She called the book a historical event in itself. Then came Lucy DeWidowich, followed by the Nobel laureate in literature, Saul Bellow, followed by the Nobel laureate in peace, Elie Wiesel. Why he got it, nobody knows. Well, I guess somebody does know. And so on and so forth. Very quickly, the book became a national bestseller, sold, went into 7 printings hardback, and it got approximately 200 reviews, ranging from ecstasy to awe. The editor and publisher of the New Republic, a fellow then and is now, the same fellow, Martin Peretz, he said, this book, if read, will change the history of the future, whatever that means, but it sounds portentous. And actually, just yesterday, somebody emailed me a statement from a declassified American, a document, a State Department document, and the State Department had this to say about the book. This was 1984. It said that Joan Peters, the U.S. State Department, Joan Peters has written the first true account of the roots of the Middle East crisis from time immemorial, in which she definitively proves that there is no historical basis for the national ethnic concept of a Palestinian. That was the kind of review or statements, those were the sort of statements you read back then when the book first came out. And truth be told, if what Joan Peters was saying were true, it would cause us to totally rethink our understanding of the conflict. Because Joan Peters claimed, and all of these famed authorities validated, that Palestine had been empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Zionist settlers came, made the proverbial desert bloom, and then all these Arabs from neighboring countries sneaked into Palestine, surreptitiously entered Palestine, pretended to be indigenous to the land, and called themselves Palestinians. I noticed some of you in the audience are laughing at the thesis of her book. I should add the book had 1,853 footnotes, as Peters liked to boast, including when she came to Columbia University Lowe Library to receive an award. She was boasting about the scholarship of her book. And although many people in my camp, so to speak, I'm a person of the left, whether the left still exists, I don't know, but I'm a person of the left. Many people in my camp were prepared and did very quickly dismiss the book, as was called back then, Zionist propaganda. I was not prepared to do so because as a young man, roughly the age of most people in this audience, that is to say in my college years, I had very deeply felt convictions, beliefs about which I was 100% and maybe even 105% sure. And I was very self-righteous about those convictions and ready to dismiss anyone who challenged them as mouthing bourgeois propaganda. And I think it's fair to say about myself that I had done an enormous amount of reading before I had reached those conclusions. It wasn't as if they were faith. So I believed I was on very firm ground in those convictions. And whenever I had any doubts, whenever I entertained any doubts, I would say, but, and name in my mind, people of great academic authority and stature who shared my views. And I would say, well, if Paul Sweezy, the eminent Marxist economist who taught at Harvard, if he thinks this is true, it must be true. Who am I to doubt him? And there were a number of other figures of equal stature. To make a long story short, I was wrong. The world came caving in on me roughly in the late 1970s. It was personally quite devastating. It wasn't just the fact of having been wrong at the level of your political convictions. There was an awful lot, to be perfectly candid, an awful lot of humiliation that all those people who I had dismissed as being naive victims of bourgeois propaganda, they were right, and I was wrong. How wrong I was, I still don't know. On my good days, I'll say 20% wrong, and on those bad days, I have to admit probably as much as I'll give it 70% wrong. But certainly, a significant chunk of what I believed was wrong. And after that very sobering experience, I decided personally, it's not going to happen again. This time, I will be very careful before I join any cause and any ideology. So, even though, as I said, most people in my camp dismissed Joan Peters' book and went merrily on their way, I was internally trembling. Could it be I was wrong again, and wrong in a big way? So I went at Joan Peters' book like Captain Ahab went at Moby Dick. And I spent weeks each day coming home from work, in particular analyzing this demographic study, which was the core of the book, and purported to prove that the Palestinians hadn't been there before the Zionist settlers came. And the truth be told, she had a very impressive supporter, Philip Hauser, who was the director of population studies at the University of Chicago. He appended a special letter at the end of her book stating, I have checked Peters' findings, and they are correct. Normally, that would have intimidated me, but something in me said, once before, I deferred to authority, and the authority was wrong. So maybe Philip Hauser is wrong too. Check for yourself. And I went at it for many, many weeks. I lived up in Washington Heights, Elwood and Nagel, for those of you who know, Sousa and Marengue territory. And one night, it was about 1:30 a.m., I'm going through the numbers, and suddenly my eyes begin to water, a chill down my spine, I begin to breathe heavily. I discover that the key number in that demographic study was a fake. It wasn't a mistake, it wasn't an error, it was clear from the way the material was organized in the charts that the number was faked. And it was an exhilarating moment. I remember Paul Sweezy later said, discovering a fraud is every scholar's eureka. And this was my eureka moment. I jumped out of the bed, paced my little studio apartment, pumped my elbow. I did it. I did it. I did it. I discovered a fraud. It was 1:30 in the morning. I was overcome with that Oprah moment. I want to share the good news. Didn't know who to call at that hour, but I am Jewish, so I called my mother. And I told her, I did it, I did it, I did it. She was a good Jewish mother. She said, I'm very proud of you, I'm very happy for you. And then came, what did you do? It was underwhelming to tell her I had found an error in a demographic study. And then I proceeded, mostly at the New York Public Library Research Division, I proceeded to go through all of the footnotes, endnotes, one by one, all 1,853, and it became very clear that the book was not only a hoax, it was a preposterous hoax. It was the sort of hoax where, in a document, she would insert an ellipsis, a dot, 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 where the word not appears. Not very sophisticated. And I wish I could say to this illustrious audience of Columbia students, graduates, and faculty that it took tremendous brain power to penetrate the mysteries of from time immemorial. But to be fair to the audience and to history and to truth, it didn't take any at all. It was a very silly book. And the real challenge came not in publishing my findings. It took only about 6 months to complete the manuscript. I rather liked the title. It was called The Protocols of Joan Peters. It took only about 6 months to complete the manuscript. The real challenge was getting the findings published. Because so many institutions and individuals had by now invested their name in from time immemorial. But how did it look when this graduate student who had only been studying the topic for 2 years, that he was able to demonstrate that the book which we were told was a historical event in itself, which would change the history of the future, that book was a preposterous hoax. And it took a long effort, no point in going rehearsing it now, before about a year later, a couple of major articles appeared. The world's leading authority in Palestinian nationalism, a fellow by the name of Yehoshua Parath at the Hebrew University, he pronounced Peters' book, quote, a sheer forgery. And then the New York Times in January 1986, finally Anthony Lewis, then a columnist for the Times, a well-known columnist, he wrote a column entitled, There Were No Indians, and basically exposed the hoax. And since then, I've devoted most of my adult life to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And as I said earlier, the main conclusion I reached, looking back now, I passed a milestone of my own about 2006. It's about 20 years since I first became involved publicly in the topic. The main conclusion I reached was that the subject is really remarkably uncomplicated. And what I want to do now is try to illustrate that claim, looking at it briefly from three dimensions. Let's first look at the history of the conflict. As most of you know, one of the main questions that always arose, has arisen, regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict is, how did those Palestinians become refugees in 1948. And that used to be the subject of great contention, dispute, and debate. In fact, the standard claim, namely, on the eve of the Arab invasion of Palestine, the Arab armies transmitted radio messages to the Palestinians telling them to flee or leave, and after the Arab armies invaded Palestine and swept the Jews into the sea, the Palestinians could return. That was the standard claim. It was called the Arab radio broadcasts explanation. That claim was long ago known not to be true. I won't go into it right now for reasons of time. I'll simply say what we were told for a very long period. It was known already not to be true, but the facts had very little impact on the actual scholarship. Come the late 1980s, Israeli scholars begin to examine the topic, most notably the Israeli historian Benny Morris. And Morris publishes what became a famous book in 1987, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Question, and he acknowledges there's nothing to this claim about Arab radio broadcasts. He says, basically, the Palestinians, and now I'm going to synthesize because he's written a lot over the years, he says, basically, the Palestinians, and now I'm using his expression, they were ethnically cleansed in 1948. He claims that the ethnic cleansing was, as it were, an accident of war. Namely, we all know that wars generate refugees, and in this case, it generated a large number of refugees. There are other historians who say, not true. The ethnic cleansing in 1948 was premeditated. It was intentional. I'm not now going to try to resolve that question. I simply want to make the point that on what's considered so contentious an issue, the range of debate now is very narrow. Everyone agrees it's an ethnic cleansing. The question is whether it was premeditated or not. To give you an insight into how uncontroversial the question is, let's take the case of Israel's former foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami. He was the one who represented Israel during the Camp David and Taba talks in 2000-2001. He just published a book entitled Scars of War, Wounds of Peace from Oxford University Press. And the Israeli foreign minister acknowledges the Palestinians were expelled in accordance with what he calls the Zionist philosophy of transfer. And in fact, it's quite illuminating to note that Shlomo Ben-Ami does not place himself in the camp of those who say it was an accident of war. No. The former Israeli foreign minister himself states they were expelled, and they were expelled intentionally with a premeditation by the Zionist armies, what became the State of Israel. So, on what's probably the most, or what's been considered the most contentious issue historically, there's barely any dispute any longer among serious historians. Let's turn to the question of the present. On the present, basically, we're talking about the human rights record in the occupied territories. And here it's a very interesting, I think, example, because Israel-Palestine is among the most heavily monitored places in the world by human rights organizations. You have the big organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. You have the local organizations, most notably B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And then you have a whole slew of other organizations, Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, and then their Palestinian counterparts. So we have a large number of organizations, and they have produced at this point a voluminous, a monumental file of reports. It must easily run together into the tens of thousands of pages over a 20-year period. Each of these organizations is fiercely independent, and each of them has its own research staff, legal staff, and field staff. And to add even more to the confusion of these massive reports of so many organizations, to add yet more to the confusion, a lot of human rights work has to do with just observation, namely very vulnerable human fallibility. So, for example, typically a human rights report will be examining what happened at this or that demonstration. So a human rights field worker goes out to a demonstration. On this side is the Palestinians. On this side is the Israeli army. And the human rights field worker first looks at the Palestinian side and asks the question, did they incite the clash? And if they did they use stones or did they use live ammunition? And if live ammunition was used, were the people using it on the periphery of the crowd or were they amid the crowd? And then the human rights field worker turns to the Israeli side. Did they initiate the clash? And if they did, were they in a life-threatening position? And if they were, did they first fire warning shots? And then if they did they aim at the legs, the torso, the head? Obviously, there's an awful lot of room for human error in that kind of observation. And for those of you who know the great Kurosawa film, Rashomon, people remember things differently. Now, what's most astonishing, when you read through the human rights record, as I had cause to do in order to publish my last book, in the thousands and thousands of pages I read through, I was quite shocked to discover only one case, where two human rights organizations disagreed on what happened at one demonstration over a 20-year period. That was it. I looked hard, and I was prepared to further investigate, were there more discrepancies? And in fact, in that one discrepancy, I did follow up. I spoke to the people at Human Rights Watch and at Amnesty to get clarity on it. But only one case in a 20-year period. It's simply not controversial. There isn't even any disagreement about Israel's human rights record in the occupied territories. Let's take an example from current times. We're told, rightfully, in my opinion, that Hamas must renounce terrorism. That seems to me a perfectly legitimate demand. Fair enough. So let's look at the record as it's been assembled by human rights organizations. From September 2000 to the present, there have been 3,500 Palestinians killed, 1,000 Israelis killed. The ratio of Palestinian to Israeli non-combatants killed, civilians, the ratio is 3 to 1. Three times as many Palestinian non-combatants have been killed as Israeli. Now, and I should also add, more Palestinian minors have been killed than all Israeli civilians combined. The figure is roughly 680. Now, some of you may protest, and on its face there seems to be reason for protest, that there is a difference between Palestinian targeting of Israeli civilians and Israeli killing of three times as many Palestinian civilians. The claim often is made on the Israeli side, it's accidental, unintentional, and it can't be compared with intentional targeting of civilians. But what do all the human rights organizations say? That the Israeli use of live ammunition is excessive, indiscriminate, and on many occasions, it deliberately targets civilians. What's the conclusion of B'Tselem? B'Tselem is the leading human rights organization on the conflict, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. It's worth listening carefully to their conclusion. When so many civilians have been killed and wounded by Israel, the lack of intent makes no difference. Israel remains responsible. What does that mean in layperson's language? Well, to borrow the distinction of Larry Summers from Harvard, regardless of intent, Israel is in effect guilty of state terrorism. That's what B'Tselem is saying. The only difference between Israeli and Hamas terrorism is that Israeli terrorism, judging by the numbers, is three times as lethal. And no demand is being put on Israel to renounce terrorism as a condition for international acceptance. That's hypocrisy. Let me now turn, we looked at the past and the present, let me now turn to the future. That is to say, how to resolve the conflict. And once again, we're confronted with the same remarkable fact, the broad agreement on how to resolve it. Everybody in this room, I'm sure, is familiar with the terminology. There is agreement, the way you resolve it is the two-state settlement, which means, according to international law, as validated by the International Court opinion, a full Israeli withdrawal from all the territories it occupied in the June 1967 war, in exchange for recognition by Israel and neighboring Arab states of Israel's right to live in peace and security with its neighbors. That's the formula. Extremely uncontroversial. How uncontroversial? We have a documentary record. Every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on the two-state settlement. 1989, the vote was 151-3, with no abstentions. The three dissenting votes, the United States, Israel, and Dominica. That's it. You fast forward to 2004, the world changed dramatically in the last 15 years. A whole social system disappeared. 40 new states were born. The UN now has 191 states. 1989, they had 154. But notwithstanding the significant world historic changes on our map, the two-state settlement remains remarkably consistent. 2004, the vote was the world on one side and seven dissents. And if you look at the UN record, it's always the same seven. The United States, Israel, Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. And that's it. And that's it. Actually, I even noticed today I got on my email a Newsmax bulletin. Some of you may have seen it. They analyzed the UN votes for the past year, and they said our only allies are Nauru and Marshall Islands and Micronesia. And that's correct. And they are the only ones who vote against the two-state settlement. Okay. Let's now turn again to the question of Hamas. Hamas, we're told, must recognize the state of Israel to the extent that that conforms with the demand of international law and the opinion of the United Nations. I think the demand is unexceptional. It's absolutely correct. But let's look at the other side of the equation again. No Israeli government, no Israeli political party, no Israeli official has ever recognized a Palestinian state within the borders affirmed in countless UN resolutions and in the World Court decision. That is, a Palestinian state in the whole of the West Bank and Gaza with Jerusalem as its capital. That's the record. There has never been a reciprocal recognition by Israel of a Palestinian state within the borders authorized by international law and the international community. Let's look at the present. As the world now demands that Hamas recognize Israel, what is Israel doing? It's building a wall that annexes 10% of the West Bank against international law, that annexes Jerusalem in violation of international law, that severs the West Bank in two in violation of international law. In addition, to judge by what B'Tselem just wrote last week, it has, I'm quoting B'Tselem, Israel has de facto annexed the Jordan Valley. It's in the process of ethnically cleansing the Jordan Valley. That's the Israeli side. So, what does the picture look like at the end of the day? The differences between Israel and Hamas are first, although Hamas has hinted, and I'm the last one to dispute, it's ambiguous, but they have hinted that they would recognize Israel on the pre-June 67 borders. Israel has always categorically opposed a Palestinian state on the June 67 borders. And while Hamas sometimes talks about destroying the Jewish state, Israel is in practice, not in words, not in talk, Israel is in practice, as we speak now, they're dismembering and destroying the Palestinian state. That's the diplomatic record. And the past, the present, the future, remarkably uncomplicated. So, where does the controversy come from? And the main argument I'm going to make this evening is most of the controversy is fabricated. There is one part where I think, or not one part, there is a part where I think you can talk about legitimate differences of opinion. Let's take the case of those Palestinian refugees again. You can agree on facts and yet reach altogether different moral conclusions. What does that mean? Take Benny Morris. Professor Morris, the leading authority in the Palestinian refugee question, he will say Palestinians, they were ethnically cleansed in 1948. Not controversial. However, as a moral judgment, separate from the factual question, Morris says, I think morally it was a good thing. I think sometimes ethnic cleansings are good things. And he gave as his first example, using his words, not mine, he said he thought the annihilation, his word, of the Native Americans in North America was a good thing because it made possible the great American Republic. And the same way he said, I think that a Jewish state was a higher good than allowing the Palestinians to live there, which he said would make impossible a Jewish state. So if you have to choose, he says, I choose ethnic cleansing. And in fact, he goes one step further and he states, I think the big mistake Israelis made in 1948 was they didn't ethnically cleanse all of the Palestinians from all of Palestine. Or you can take the case of Professor Dershowitz from Harvard. He speaks in the question of ethnic cleansing in what he calls his autobiography, Chutzpah. And he calls ethnic cleansing a fifth-rate human rights issue analogous to massive urban renewal. Again, a different moral judgment, not disputing the facts. Now, one can't say that such moral judgments are wrong in the sense that facts are wrong. You can say they are despicable moral judgments, but you cannot say they are wrong. Or, let's look at a more complicated question. Let's take someone like, or let's begin, you can have a case where people agree on the facts, agree in their moral judgments, agree in their legal judgments, but disagree in their political judgments. Well, how can that be? That seems a little confusing. Let's take those refugees again. We can agree factually that Palestinians were expelled in 1948. Morally, that it was an abomination. Legally, that they have the right to return. And yet disagree and say, but I don't think politically it's possible. And that's the position, as many of you know, of Professor Chomsky. The factual question, uncontroversial. Morally, of course, it's an abomination. Legally, of course, they have the right to return. But he says, politically, I don't think it's going to happen. And I think it's immoral to be telling Palestinian refugees in Lebanon that they're going home when they're not going to be going home. I happen to think those are legitimate differences. That is to say, honest people can agree to disagree. I'm not saying who I think is right or wrong. I think that's a separate question. I think it's a legitimate difference. However, I have to, having made that acknowledgement, stress another point. It will come as a surprise, I think, to some members of the audience and perhaps all. In fact, it came as a surprise to me. There is absolutely no controversy whatsoever in the international community or in international law on the Palestinian right to return. That's not controversial. If you look at the UN vote for 2003 on the question of the right of return, The vote was 167-1. That's not close. Now, some of you are skeptical about the United Nations. Fair enough. I don't agree, but I can acknowledge your skepticism. But then let's turn to the human rights organizations. In 2000, Human Rights Watch issued a lengthy statement on the right of return. And they stated that it urges Israel to recognize the Palestinian right of return. In 2001, Amnesty International issued a statement. It calls for Palestinians to be able to exercise their right of return. It's simply not controversial. Once you begin looking at the documentary record, the legal record, and the UN record. All right, acknowledging an area of what I call, for lack of a better term, legitimate disagreement, I think now we have to look at that much larger area of illegitimate disagreement, fabricated disagreement. And there are three basic kinds that I want to look at this evening. The first kind is this mystification of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The claim that it's so complicated that it requires a knowledge the equivalent of rocket science to penetrate its intricacies. It's about ancient enmities, the cosmic clash of religions or civilizations. Or we're told in the fancy Latin term, it's sui generis. It can't be compared. The conflict is so complicated, don't try to compare it. Well, in fact, the conflict is not complicated at all. I'll illustrate it in a moment. But what's the purpose of this shrouding of the conflict in this mystification, in this cloud of confusion? First of all, its purpose is to convince the observer to suspend ordinary moral judgments. So, if Israel systematically tortures Palestinian detainees and legalizes it, and is the only country in the world to have legalized it, if Israel practices collective punishment in the form of house demolitions and legalizes it, and is the only country in the world to legalize it, if Israel takes hostages and legalizes it, calling them bargaining chips, and is the only country in the world to do so, the normal moral impulse is to condemn it. But no, we're told, it only seems wrong. If you really understood the conflict, if you could penetrate its mysteries and its intricacies, you would realize that what seems wrong is not actually wrong. And the other purpose of this mystification of the conflict is to convince the observer not to make the obvious analogies. Because whenever you make the obvious analogies, Israel comes out on the wrong side. So do not compare. The Israel-Palestine conflict is unique. Don't compare it to what happened to Native Americans in North America, because when you make the analogy, Israel doesn't look very good. Or currently, don't compare it with apartheid, because if you compare it with apartheid, Israel doesn't look very good. Now, I know that President Bollinger of Colombia, he's written that the apartheid analogy is both grotesque and offensive. But the question is it? Let's look at what human rights organizations have to say. Let's look at what Israeli human rights organizations have to say. In May 2002, B'Tselem put out a very hefty report on Israeli settlement policy in the occupied territories. It was called Land Grab, and it concludes as follows. Israel has created in the occupied territories a regime of separation based on discrimination, applying two separate systems of law in the same area, and basing the rights of individuals on their nationality. So far, the technical discussion. And then they say, this regime, note carefully, this regime is the only one of its kind in the world and is reminiscent of distasteful regimes from the past, such as the apartheid regime in South Africa. If you look at their March 2005 report entitled Forbidden Roads, it says the same thing, that Israel has created a racist apartheid regime or similar, a regime similar to the racist apartheid regime in South Africa until 1994. All right. That's Israeli human rights organizations. Former Israeli Knesset member Shulamit Aloni, she made the analogy. Haaretz correspondent Gideon Levy, he made the analogy. South African Archbishop and Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu, he made the analogy. Former Israeli ambassador to South Africa, Alon Liel, he made the analogy. The father of human rights law in South Africa, John Dugard, he made the analogy. For all of you who are still convinced it's anti-Semitic, none other than Ariel Sharon is reported to have made the analogy. Haaretz reports that in meeting with the Italian ambassador, he stated that my goal for the occupied territories is to create Bantustans on the South African model. Now, maybe they're all wrong. It's possible. And the apartheid analogy is misplaced. That's possible. But to denounce the analogy as, quote, grotesque and offensive, that's a form of intellectual terrorism. Okay. That's a form of intellectual terrorism designed to shut down discussion altogether. And I think, and I mean this, because I'll tell you honestly as a youth, there was no institution I respected more than Columbia. I mean that. It just has that feeling about it. I have the highest regard for it. And I think it's a sorry day for this great institution when the president of it subordinates the pursuit of truth to the pursuit of fundraising. I think that's sad. Not to say that he's the only one, but Larry Summers lost his job. Well, what does the historical record show on this question of its complicatedness? What's really remarkable when you go through the record is when historians look at it, they never say it's complicated. Or when officials look at it. Most of you know in this room that for a long period, Palestine was under a British mandate from 1917 to 1947. And periodically in Palestine, there were revolts, rebellions, and so forth. And every time there was a revolt or a rebellion, the British government would send a parliamentary investigative team to find out why are the natives restless. And the teams would produce extremely impressive documents written with the British flair for language, and also the British were very competent colonial administrators. The reports were excellent. It's not Judy Miller. It's serious. And when you read the reports, they all have these very long historical sections. If you, for example, look at the most famous of them, the Peel Commission report. And the Peel Commission report states, in the long passages in the history, they say the word that keeps reappearing is obvious, obvious, obviously obvious. All the time, it keeps recurring. Why are the Palestinians restless? Why are they angry, or as they were called then, the Arabs of Palestine? The British said it's obvious. All the neighboring states have gotten their independence or are on their way to getting their independence, except the Arabs of Palestine. So it's obvious why they're rebelling. And then they go on to say that these Arabs see all these Jews pouring into Palestine. They say they're going to create a Jewish state. And the Arabs are worried that when they finally do get their independence, that they are going to be in the minority, and who the heck knows what's going to happen to them. The British said, it's obvious why the Palestinian or the Arabs of Palestine are rebelling. Not complicated at all. They acknowledge that resolving the conflict, that's complicated. But its source and its roots, not complicated at all. Or turn, for example, to that fellow I mentioned earlier, Benny Morris. I suspect many of you in your classes use his book. It's a standard textbook now, Righteous Victims. And at one point, Morris himself asks the question, why do these Palestinians loathe Zionism? And he replies, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. The fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Now, some of you I know have a perplexed look on your face. What's so important about that, and why did I belabor it by reading it twice? Well, actually, when I came across those words, they kind of leapt off the page for me, metaphorically, of course. I don't use drugs. Why? Because notice what Morris doesn't say. He doesn't say the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism was anti-Semitism. He does not say it was hatred of Jews. He does not say it was fear of the Enlightenment. He does not say it was dread of the emancipation of women. No. The explanation is very obvious. They feared that they would lose their homes and perhaps their country. Not complicated. As it turned out, the fear was very rational. In fact, what's so peculiar about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that in any other conflict, were you to apply the sorts of explanations which are typically conjured up in the case of Israel and Palestine, people would laugh at them in ridicule. So, for example, if your great professor of history, Eric Foner, were delivering a lecture on the American West, and he wanted to pretend to profundity, as many professors like to do, and he were to say that the chief motor of Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment, and that resistance was very bloody, it was not for no reason that they were called savages. The other side was very savage too. But we should remember the Native Americans killed men, they killed women, they killed children. It was a bloody resistance. But what if Professor Foner were to say the chief motor of Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment was anti-Europeanism or anti-Christianism or anti-whiteism? You would laugh, because the obvious explanation also happens to be a sufficient one. You don't need to conjure up exotic explanations about clashes of religion, clashes of civilization, ancient enmities. The obvious explanation, just like the Native Americans feared for territorial displacement and dispossession, so the Palestinians then and now fear territorial displacement and dispossession. Not complicated. No need for the mystification. The second kind of fabricated controversy is the playing of the Holocaust card, the dragging in of the Nazi Holocaust in the Israel-Palestine conflict, or you can say the conscription of the Nazi Holocaust in the Israel-Palestine conflict. The Holocaust industry first emerges after the June 1967 war, and its purpose was to immunize Israel from criticism. Its main contribution is what came to be called, for those who've studied the literature, the uniqueness doctrine, the notion that no one in the history of humanity ever suffered the way Jews suffered during World War II. Intellectually, the doctrine is vacuous, while morally, this ranking of suffering is an abomination. But its purpose, it has a rational purpose, a political purpose, and that is to apply to Jews in Israel a different moral standard. If Jews suffered uniquely, they can't be held to ordinary notions of right and injustice. And that's how it's been used. I have no time now to go into it, but I want to give some illustrations from current events. The Holocaust has not just been used as a bludgeon to silence criticism of Israel, but really in what can only be described as a grotesque paradox, it's become the main ideological weapon for waging aggressive war. So, in 2002, critics of the United States' illegal aggression against Iraq were constantly accused of appeasing the new Hitler. And now, those who are criticizing the drumbeat of war against Iran are again being accused of appeasing Hitler and paving the way for a new Holocaust. Some of you are wondering, where could I have dreamt that up? That's fair enough. I happen to subscribe to the World Jewish Digest, which is a collection of the main articles from Jewish periodicals in the United States. I got my copy in the mail this week, and the headline is "The Price of Appeasement." and how we have to now go on the attack against Iran. And Phyllis Chesler, that well-known expert on Arab anti-Semitism, who is emphatic on the point that India is an Arab country, she says it twice in her book. I respect that certitude. She writes, "My friends, the clock is ticking. By my reckoning, it is now 1941 all over again. We have no time to waste. A strong resistance to the totalitarian Islamists will prove essential in the war of civilizations that is upon us." It's an irony, as I said, that at least one of the greatest testaments, one, I won't say the, one of the greatest testaments to the horrors of war has now been turned into the ideological juggernaut for waging aggressive war in this world. The Holocaust is not just a political weapon and an economic weapon, but now it has degenerated into the verbal equivalent of spittle. Those critical of Israeli policy or Jewish organizations routinely labeled Holocaust deniers and revisionists. It's only a matter of time before Holocaust denier enters the dictionary of American slang as a synonym for the F word, as in Holocaust you and Mother Holocauster. It will be cause for wonder. It will be cause for wonder to future generations how such a horrific chapter in the history of human suffering came to be reduced, including in the pages of your school paper, came to be reduced to a shmata, a rag. The most recent version of this Holocaust card is what's called the new anti-Semitism. And there are two things to say about the new anti-Semitism. Number one, it's not new. And number two, it has nothing whatsoever to do with anti-Semitism. Every time Israel comes under international pressure to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict diplomatically, or whenever it faces a major publication's debacle, it revives the new anti-Semitism extravaganza. So, you have an excellent library at Columbia. Go to Butler Library. Type in "The New Anti-Semitism." It's the title of a book. The book came out not in 2000 or 2001, came out in 1974. The head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, for those of you who don't know it, it specializes in the defamation of character of anyone critical of Israel. The ADL puts out a book. The head of the organization is a fellow named Arnold Foster. He and his colleague Benjamin Epstein, they put out a book called "The New Anti-Semitism." 1981, the new head of the ADL is a fellow named Nathan Perlmutter. He and his wife, Ruth Ann, they put out a book called "The Real Anti-Semitism." Main thesis, there's a new anti-Semitism in the world. And then come the year 2000, there are all of these. There's a raft of books and magazine articles about a new anti-Semitism. What's really striking when you've had a chance to read through the literature is not only at the level of general theme, but even at the level of detail. It's a case of everything old is new again. So if you go back to that 1974 book called The New Anti-Semitism, one of the centerpieces of their evidence of this new anti-Semitism is this Broadway show that's been made into a Hollywood film. The show is called Jesus Christ Superstar. And the ADL says it's replete with anti-Semitism. And it's a curious story. The director of the cinematic version is a fellow named Norman Jewison. He is not Jewish, but he just put out his autobiography. I was thumbing through it from curiosity. And he begins by saying, I always wanted to be Jewish. That was my thing in life. Don't ask me why, that's what I wanted. He says he grows up, he becomes a famous director, he gets to meet Prime Minister Golda Meir, he's thrilled. And now his thrill metamorphoses into ecstasy when he's told that he will direct the cinematic version of Fiddler on the Roof. Most of you know, I assume. And he produces or directs cinema, Fiddler on the Roof, and everyone loves him. He is the toast of the town in Jewish communities. Then he's offered the opportunity to do the cinematic version of Jesus Christ Superstar. And he writes in his book, I don't know what happened. Everyone's now calling me an anti-Semite. I don't know what I did wrong. And he points out not only him, but the fellow who did the score for the Broadway show and then the music for the cinematic version, this fellow named Andrew Lloyd Webber. He's now being called an anti-Semite. Now, most of you know Andrew Lloyd Webber went on to make other notorious, or write the score for other notorious anti-Semitic productions like Cats, which many people claim is a coded reference to the Cats family. Well, why do I mention all of this? It happens that the first chapter of the book I just wrote is entitled From Jesus Christ Superstar to Passion of the Christ, because it was very striking, the same attacks that Mel Gibson came under were the ones that Jewison came under. And I felt vindicated when I read in Mr. Jewison's autobiography, he writes at one point, he says, the same thing that happened to me happened to Mel Gibson. And he was perplexed. The answer was obvious, because it had nothing to do with the film. The film was just being used to create, to foment this hysteria about a new anti-Semitism. What is the evidence for it, for the new anti-Semitism? The evidence is a flat zero. I'm not going to go through the case here because this is Columbia University. And Columbia University turned out by serendipity, or maybe not by serendipity, to be the laboratory test case for this claim of a new anti-Semitism, because all the publications were claiming it was particularly rampant on college campuses. I have to confess, I was kind of surprised by that claim. For reasons not of choice, I've taught at many universities. And one thing you can say about American universities now, for better or for worse, and I think it's a mixed picture, they're very politically correct. You can't be anti-anything on a college campus nowadays. You can't be anti-black, anti-Puerto Rican, anti-tall, anti-short, anti-fat, anti-skinny. You can't be anti-downright ugly. You just can't on a college campus. So it was a kind of perplexity. How could it be that amidst all of this political correctness, there could be rampant anti-Semitism verging on if not going beyond, we were told, pogroms on college campuses. And as I said, the test case became Colombia, because here we were told that virulent disease was particularly rampant. Without going through the details, which I suspect are familiar to everyone in this room, the conclusion of the investigative report of the ad hoc committee was they found one case of one class, of one lecture, on one day where one professor responded heatedly to a question defending Israeli actions in Jenin. That was it. Period. One day, one class, one lecture, one professor responded heatedly. But, truth be told, that's not all they found. That's what they found on the question of anti-Semitism. They also found that a student was secretly videotaping a professor's lectures. They found a professor in one of, I think it was the medical school, told students to go into classes and report back to him what these professors were saying. And what was most interesting about the report, to my thinking, was what began as an investigation of anti-Semitism. The harshest language in the report was reserved for those, and now I think I'm quoting it almost exactly, those who were threatening to turn students into informers. Namely, the real problem was not anti-Semitism, of which the report found exactly zero evidence. The real problem was that there were some people on this college campus who were trying to suppress freedom of speech and discussion on this topic. Now, I certainly don't mind being booed, and I think it's your right, but those who are booing, please bear in mind, you're now blaming the messenger for the message. That's what your university report found. I'm just telling you. On the question of European anti-Semitism, it's a complicated one. Well, it's not complicated. It's a long one. I go through all the reports in what I've written. I'll just summarize for you briefly the main finding. What's considered to be the most reputable mainstream survey organization, the Pew Research Center, in 2003, it did do an investigation of anti-Semitism in Europe because of all of the talk about a new anti-Semitism. And what did it find? It's interesting. It's also never reported here. It found that not only is there no evidence of a new anti-Semitism in Europe, they said as compared to the last time they did their survey in 1991, it's actually significantly declined. The new anti-Semitism is a fiction. It's a fabrication. What's its purpose? Pretty obvious. First of all, it's to turn the perpetrator, Israel and its apologists, into the victim, focusing on the alleged suffering of Jews rather than the very real suffering of Palestinians. And the second purpose is to discredit all criticism of Israel as being motivated by anti-Semitism. Israel, we're told, is the collective Jew, and the irrational hatred directed against Jews in the past is now being directed against Israel. The possibility that this criticism of Israel might be justified is a priori precluded. It must be anti-Semitism, or so goes the claim of those who are claiming a new anti-Semitism. I want to look at one last topic, and for an academic audience, in many ways, it's the most dispiriting one, and that is the vast proliferation of fraud that a fraud on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Everybody here knows, you are internet savvy, much more than me, I'm sure. I'm strong at booting up, but that's where it ends. About 70% of what you read on the web, about 70%, consists of information ranging from lunacy to crackpottery. And about 30% has different, you know, scientific value content. So to claim that there's a lot of fraud on any particular topic is not a particularly brilliant insight, or in fact, a particularly important insight. However, the uniqueness of the Israel-Palestine conflict is that the fraud is validated by mainstream media and publications. I began my talk a while ago. I began my talk with the Joan Peters fraud in 1984. And now I'll end my remarks with a more recent example of how this works. Everybody who's involved in academic life knows we have these, for lack of a better term, mechanisms of quality control. And we're all familiar with them, maybe not as a technical term, but as a reality. So I see in the second row, Professor Bilgrami. Okay. Professor Bilgrami approaches me one day in the street, and he says to me, "You know, Norm, I was just reading a book, and this book demonstrates, that everything you've been saying about Israel's human rights record, it's a lie. Because according to the book I was reading, Israel's human rights record is generally superb." That's what the author says. Well, now I take on the sarcastic tone of an academic. My eyes squint with skepticism, and I say to Professor Bilgrami, "Really? Generally superb?" He says, "Yeah." He's a man of his convictions. So I then ask him, starting to go through the mechanisms of quality control, I say to Professor Bilgrami, "Who published that book?" Because we all know books have different range of scholarly content. You have what's called at one end of the spectrum the vanity presses, and at the other end of the spectrum are generally considered to be the university presses, because they have a policy of what's called peer review, which basically means one or two other experts in the field have to examine the book and give it a thumbs up. Well, Professor Bilgrami is not daunted by that question. He says, "John Wiley and Sons." Well, I have to concede that's not a crackpot publisher. It's not a vanity press. John Wiley and Sons, it's an excellent press. So now I ask him, "Okay, who blurbed that book? Who wrote comments on the back?" Well, he's pleased by that question. He says, "Who blurbed the book?" There's a blurb by Floyd Abrams, the leading First Amendment lawyer in the United States. There's a blurb by Henry Louis Gates of Harvard. It's an impressive roster. Well, I can't dispute that. So I go through that go to the third mechanism of quality control. And I asked Professor Bill Grammi, okay, what kind of reviews did that book get? Well, once again, he's not intimidated in the least. He said the book got excellent reviews. It got an excellent review in the Boston Globe, and it got an excellent review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. And it wasn't just anyone who reviewed it in the Sunday Times Book Review. It was Ethan Bronner. Ethan Bronner is the Times' resident expert on the Israel-Palestine conflict. He writes their editorials on the topic. He sits on their editorial board. Well, it would be difficult to dismiss that. So I now ask him the last question, desperate but hopeful. I ask him, who wrote that book? What's his academic pedigree? Community college? No, says Professor Bogrami. Who wrote the book? It was written by the senior most professor at Harvard Law School. It was written by Alan Dershowitz. It's true. It's true. I never deny truth when it stares me in the face. It had an excellent publisher, excellent blurbs, excellent reviews, and as a lowly professor aspiring still, I always say I hope I'll get a job before I retire, a lowly professor, I of course have to defer to Professor Dershowitz's academic pedigree at Harvard. Excellent academic pedigree. It's all true. And notwithstanding the fact that it's all true, it's also the case that the book is a fraud. It's a hoax. Every word in that book, there's a question about where to begin. Some people think that the first word of the first page, that's where the hoax begins. Other people in another camp claim that the hoax begins with the author's name. But wherever you begin, the book is a flat-out fraud. Actually, it's such a ridiculous fraud that the first couple of chapters are plagiarized from Joan Peters's From Time Immemorial. Now, I have to tell you, I thought that was kind of funny. I started to read the book, and I said, that sounds familiar. And that sounds familiar. And I pulled off my Joan Peters From Time Immemorial, blew off the dust, put both books on my bed, and started to compare. It was the same book. I thought it was funny. Okay, we know at Harvard Law School, you kind of need to plagiarize in order to get a job. Okay. But plagiarize from a hoax? I found that funny. Actually, there are two connections between that book and your university. Number one, Professor Dershowitz singles out for praise President Bullinger for his position on Israel. And number two, you may recall that President Bullinger recruited as the impartial judge for the ad hoc committee. He recruited Floyd Abrams. And Floyd Abrams, that sage scholar on the Israel-Palestine conflict, he was one of the leading endorsers of Dershowitz's hoax. Well, Again, I have to admit, it did not take me any great, it didn't require any great skill to demonstrate the book was a hoax. The book was preposterous. There are claims throughout the book, things like Palestinian suicide bombers are purposely spreading AIDS and hepatitis B. That Palestinian female suicide bombers, they had been raped by Fatah militants, and that's why they were going on their missions. That sort of silliness. It took me a relatively short period in order to produce a fairly substantial manuscript demonstrating the book was nonsense, a fake. And once again, the same problem recurred as happened in 1984. Documenting the hoax was not the challenge. The challenge was publicizing it. As some of you are aware, Professor Dershowitz began writing lengthy letters to my first publisher, running from 5 to 8 pages, single-spaced. There were 4 letters. They're posted on my website. At that point, my publisher had some concerns, and I switched to another publisher, University of California Press. Professor Dershowitz then began bombarding that press with letters. When the press stood firm, he then hired what's reputed to be the most powerful law firm in the country, Cravath, Swain, and Moore, to bombard the press with letters. When the press still stood firm, he then went to the Terminator. He went to Governor Schwarzenegger of California. And to Governor Schwarzenegger's credit, he stated that he considered this a matter of academic freedom and he would not interfere. Whether he knew what he was talking about is a matter of speculation. And the book went through an unusual vetting process. There was not one, not two, not three, not four. There were 5 libel lawyers. I used to call them the 5 humorless libel lawyers because by the end they had taken out every attempt at humor on my part, which was a disappointment to me at any rate. And then it went through a very extensive peer review process, not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, but 7 peer reviews, including a chair at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, a chair at Oxford, a chair at MIT, a chair of Judaic Studies at Berkeley, and a senior researcher at Harvard. And they all gave the book an enthusiastic thumbs up, and then the book would seem to have had a happy ending. It was published in August of this past year. There's an interesting, I think, footnote. Normally, when a book gets the kind of pre-publication publicity that mine did, because of Professor Dershowitz's lawsuits became a matter of the public record, and there was an enormous number of articles written, normally reviewers are scrambling over each other's shoulders to be the first to review the book. Well, it's been 6 months, and there has literally not been one mainstream review of the book in the whole of the United States. It's an amazing achievement. Some would think I'm bitter. And there were moments of bitterness, but the bitterness eventually turned into awe and bewilderment. I mean that. Not since the days of the glorious leader Enver Hoxha of People's Albania has there been such party discipline. It's very impressive. I searched my history books. I was once a student of Russian history, looking hard for a comparable case apart from People's Albania. And the only other case I could come up with was the 1938 meeting of the Stalin Central Committee It was very united. Very united. Because he shot everyone in the 1937 Central Committee meeting. But in the United States, no one needs to be shot. When it comes to Israel and Palestine, everyone knows exactly what to do and what not to do for the glorious cause. I would never end, as a matter of principle, on such a downbeat note. On the other hand, I would never give you hope if I believed there were no hope. I believe there is grounds for hope. And the reason I believe is there's grounds for hope can be found in my remarks towards the end. If you read Professor Dershowitz's book, or the book allegedly written by him, if you read The Case for Israel, a large chunk of it is devoted to Israel's human rights record. And as Professor Bilgrami was emphatic in stating, he claims that Israel's human rights record is generally superb. But what's most striking when you read that chunk of the book is not once, literally, not once does he cite any mainstream human rights organization to support his claims. He'll denounce Amnesty, he'll denounce B'Tselem, but he'll never cite them. Now that's illuminating, because obviously, if he could cite them, he would. They would lend credibility and intellectual moral luster to his case. He doesn't cite them because he can't cite them. You cannot possibly cite mainstream human rights organization publications and come to the conclusion that Israel's record is generally superb. The only conclusion you can reach is it's generally abysmal. Why is that hopeful? Because it means that truth is on our side. Justice is on our side. If we learn to wield the weapons of truth and justice, I'm old-fashioned enough to believe, and those are youthful ideals I'll never give up. I'm old-fashioned enough to believe if we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice, we can win. The other side, they have power aplenty. And they have money aplenty. And as the experience of the past week illustrates, if in a tiny way, they are ruthless. That's true. But I still say, if we learn to wield the weapons of truth and justice, and if we keep in mind those wonderfully inspiring words from the African American spiritual, keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Don't let them personalize it. Don't let them get you down. And don't forget what it's all about. It's not about me personally. It's not about anyone personally. It's about something much bigger than any of us as individuals. It's about the fundamental questions of truth and justice. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Thank you.
Professor Finkelstein. Thank you very much for those quite lengthy comments. I appreciate them very much. My name is Noah. I graduated Columbia last year. I, too, am a man of the left, proud to be one. I was a member of the anti-war coalition when I was here. And I think that you raised a number of important issues. First, I just want to speak specifically to that ad hoc faculty report because I believe I'm qualified to do so, appearing in the movie Columbia Unbecoming. I want to say that not once did a single student who appeared in that film ever accuse any of those professors of anti-Semitism. And there might be people in this room who will say otherwise, but I believe that they are motivated by animus and by something other than the truth. And I want you to know, and the rest of the room to know, but you to know, that not one of those students accused any of those professors of anti-Semitism. That's first. And I believe that we can educate each other a lot about that, and I look forward to talking to you about that. I'm a man of the left. I'm proud that you mentioned the Palestinian refugees who deserve to be recognized. I think that a lot of injustice has been done to them. It's astounding to me that 101 United Nations resolutions have been passed. Not one of them have talked about the Jewish refugees from Arab countries and Muslim countries. And I want to know what your thoughts are about that. And I also want to know, while we're on the topic of United Nations and of human rights organizations, which I care very deeply about, if the situation is as you make it seem, if it is as cut and dry and as obvious, as you keep on repeating, among the human rights organizations, isn't it a problem to you in terms of prospects for peace and for truth and justice that none of these human rights organizations speak about or condemn the murder, murder of innocent Israeli women and children, for that matter, the mutilation and gender killing of Muslim and Palestinian women, the torture and arrest of Muslim gays, the assassinations and political repression of political apostates. Isn't that a problem that none of these human rights organizations are talking about that, if what you say is the case?
Well, I agree it would be a problem were what you were saying correct. Now, let's look at the human rights organization publications. Let's take, for example, Human Rights Watch. By far, the largest publication, it turned out, was the several hundred page publication on Palestinian suicide bombers. That was their largest publication by far. Number two, if you look at the publications as they come out, every time there is a Palestinian suicide bombing, every time, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and B'Tselem will condemn it. It's simply not true what you're saying. It's factually incorrect. There is one aspect of what you're saying which is true. But then you have to understand the context. That is, and I hope people will listen and bear me out for a moment, the question of casualties is only one aspect of the whole human rights picture. And on casualties, there is roughly the same amount of space devoted to the Israeli and Palestinian side. However, it looks as if the human rights community is overwhelmingly focused on the Palestinians. But that's because it's Israelis who are methodically and systematically torturing Palestinian detainees, not the other way around. Why? There are no Israeli detainees in Palestinian prisons. But what do the human rights reports show? Let's take the case of torture. Human Rights Watch reports, just during the period of the First Intifada, 1987 to 93, just in that period, I'm quoting them, tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees were tortured. They said an astonishing number when you juxtaposed it against the total adult male population, which is about 750,000. Let's take a second case, house demolitions. It's not Palestinians who are demolishing Israeli homes. It's the other way around. It's thousands of Palestinian homes which have been demolished. Now, under international law, those are war crimes. And I can go down the list. The reason the publication, the total number, is so disproportionate is very simple. Allow me to say simple again. Why? Because it's Israel that's occupying Palestine, and not Palestine that's occupying Israel. And on the first question, I'm not going to speak authoritatively on it. I don't want to evade it. I simply have to say, in honesty, the scholarship on what happened in 1948 to the Jewish refugees from the Arab world, I would say, a nice way of putting it is, it's undeveloped. So, before I get boos and oh, let's take the case of the Iraqi Jews. Most of you in the audience know or have heard of the Israeli scholar who is of Iraqi descent, Avi Shlaim. And he was one of those who left in 1948. And Shlaim, in a recent interview, being among those who left, he was very emphatic. They were not expelled. They left. That's what he says. He does say a legitimate issue of compensation arises. And I'm willing to defer to him on that. He's more knowledgeable than me, for sure, on that topic. But he says it was not an expulsion. To the extent that you can document an expulsion, I have no problem with the same standard being applied. That, to me, is unproblematic. Okay. I think you want to see a hypocrite in me and an enemy in me, but you're mistaken. I try very hard. I make a desperate attempt to be fair. But I cannot change what the record shows. You show me, where, for example, in the question of torture, the human rights organizations disagree. I couldn't find it. Thank you.
We will have to go to mic number 3 now.
You once said, the honorable thing now is to show solidarity with Hezbollah as the U.S. and Israel target it for liquidation. Hezbollah is identified by the State Department as a terrorist organization. It has killed 241 American Marines and countless Jews. And I'd like to understand how you justify this statement and whether or not you would apply it to Hamas.
Okay. Number one, just on the factual issue, because I did notice that statement in the Columbia Spectator as well, strictly on the factual question of Hezbollah having killed the 241 Marines. I'm not making any statement on whether it's right, wrong. That's aside for the moment. I'm simply saying on the factual question, nobody knows who was behind it. I've searched the literature quite closely on that because Professor Dershowitz claimed it was Palestinians who blew up the barracks in 1983. And I checked around. So that's simply a factual question. We don't know. Now, let's turn to the question you raise, my support for Hezbollah. I know that must terrify people and shock them, or some people in the audience. And for others, it may look like a radical pose of a well-placed or a comfortable professor. I think it's neither. It's trying to be consistent. Now, I happen to have been on Al-Manar, Hezbollah television, and the issue came up. And I said to them simply, during World War II, had I been around, I would most certainly have supported the communist-led resistance to foreign occupation. I would most certainly, emphatically, undeniably, and without equivocation, have supported the heroic victory of the Soviet Red Army over the Nazi aggressors. No question about it. Now, Stalin's record on human rights is nothing to envy, and the record of the Communist Party resistances on question of human rights is nothing to envy. But on the fundamental question, does any people have the right to expel foreign aggressors from its soil? I don't think that's a difficult question. And that's what Hezbollah... That's what Hezbollah did, and I frankly consider it a great victory for the Arab people. I do. Now, I know it will be wildly quoted tomorrow, hopefully not on page one of the Post. However, anyone on a moment's reflection, anyone would grasp there is nothing in principle different between that statement and saying you celebrate the heroic victory of the Soviet Red Army in turning back the foreign aggressors. In fact, my guess is Hezbollah's record on human rights is rather better than Stalin's. Would anyone find that a morally problematic statement? If I may be personal for a moment, I'm very glad that Stalin defeated the Nazis, because otherwise I wouldn't be here today.
Professor Finkelstein, I will unfortunately have to ask you to try and keep your responses a bit more prompt, because we have a long line of questioners waiting. Mic number four, please.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth. I'm with the Revolutionary Marxist Spartacus Youth Club. And I wanted to, first of all, state our defense with Professor Finkelstein against the slander campaign that's been waged in the press and on campus. Also to state our defense with the oppressed Palestinian people, but with the recognition that the United Nations is not a force for the defense of the oppressed people, as in Sabra and Shatila. It's a fig leaf for U.S. imperialism, as the starvation blockade of Iraq showed that killed more people than the U.S. occupation. There is no solution to the national conflict in the Near East as long as the region remains under the thumb of the U.S. murderous U.S. imperialists and their underlings in the Zionist state and the Arab bourgeoisies. We call for a socialist federation of the Near East and seek to build
Would
a party
it be possible
of the international
to get your
working
question,
class. Yes, I have a question. Which is, okay, I'm sorry, I have a question. All right. Which is, I've heard several comments up here about Stalinism, about the Soviet Union. Obviously, the collapse of the Soviet Union meant not only massive social collapse, unemployment, disease and poverty in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but also that Palestine no longer had the ability to maneuver between the Soviet Union, which had been their backer, against the Israeli. How do you think that affects the situation in the Near East today?
I'm going to give you a very idiosyncratic answer to that question. As a young man, I was a person of one sect of the left, and a very good friend of mine, he was the head of the Spartacist Youth League. And he always accused me of being bourgeois, or even worse, petty bourgeois. Well, I more or less stuck to my principles. But Sam Isakharov became a very well-heeled class action lawyer, taught at Columbia Law School, and was recently bought by NYU Law School. So I'm unimpressed when Spartacists try to teach me lessons about politics.
We're going to have to go to mic number one, please.
But good luck to Sam.
Okay, first I would like really to thank you. It was really the most interesting lecture that I heard in this country so far. So thank you. This is the first thing. Two quick things. The first thing, I still puzzled how it can be that I'm a Palestinian and Israeli citizen, at least nominally, and I read the Hebrew newspaper daily, how it can be that in Israel itself, not only in Haaretz, but even in the popular newspaper like Yedot Ahronot Amariv, you can feel much like almost 100, like, you know, 10 times at least, critical articles against Israeli policy and its violation of human rights. And in America, things, people are even approaching this topic and using the language that Amir Ahas using as colonization and apartheid, that it's became part of the Israeli mainstream discourse. In America, you cannot even touch, do you know this? Is America like more pop, more Catholic than the Pope in this regard? Just, you know, I will hear. The second thing, you were talking about, you know, the two-state solution. And I want to talk about myself. You know, I am living in my, you know, in my, I'm the native there, but Israel itself is a racist country. It defined itself as the state of the Jews. It means if I'm living there, paying taxes, speaking the language, this country would say for me, you will never be even a citizen there. So how this two-state solution is going to say to solve my situation there? Thank you. Okay.
On the first question about the tolerance of a much broader spectrum of debate in Israel, I think that's, of course, factually accurate. But morally, it's a two-edged sword. Because if people are getting solid, sound information about what's going on there, and they do nothing about it, it speaks very poorly for the population. Yes, it's a democracy for a large, the overwhelming percentage of its citizens, but sometimes democracies, the fact that you're a democracy speaks not in your favor, but in your disfavor. Germans always have the moral alibi. It's a weak one, in my opinion. But they always have the moral alibi that Nazi Germany was a totalitarian state and they didn't know. But Israelis don't have that alibi. Each day they can read Amir Ahas or Gideon Levy or many others and they just go their merry way. So the fact that it's a democracy speaks rather poorly for them, I think. On the second question, I don't fully agree with you because I think the fact that Israel discriminates against its citizens is not of it's not of the same order as an occupation. Our society for the longest time, juridically, and I think honest people will say today de facto, discriminates between its citizens. And those are jobs, as it were, that are undone, that need to be completed to democratize the society. And that's a challenge in Israel, but let's not be so arrogant as to pretend we don't have the same problem here in a big way. But the occupation, I think, raises separate issues because the Palestinians have no legal rights whatsoever. And as we speak now, Palestine is being carved up and rapidly disappearing.
Can we go to mic number two?
Thank you for your talk. My question is, it's been said that opposition to the Palestinian people has often been built on existing racist ideologies, using the Palestinians as like a savage, non-white population. Can you comment on specifically how that pervades academic language and media coverage of the issue?
In a short period of time, if it's possible.
Okay, book one. No. I think that it's fairly obvious that every colonial adventure needs to fabricate those sorts of mythology. And, for example, we laughed earlier at Joan Peters claiming that Palestine was empty when the Zionist settlers came, but we shouldn't laugh too heartily because those of us who are roughly of my age cohort and older will remember that that's how we were told the West looked. It was, in the standard language when I was growing up, it was a virgin land and it was a wilderness. And if you look across time and space, and I do so in a book I've written, you'll see that the same sorts of mythologies about an empty land, virgin land, wilderness, savages, and so on and so forth, they crop up everywhere. The only thing that occasionally changes is the language. So if you read Teddy Roosevelt, his Winning of the West, he's very emphatic in denouncing those savages. Nowadays, they don't call them savages, they call them terrorists. But the same principle, I think, the same moral principle is operative.
We'll take three questions at a time now, and we would really appreciate if you could make them brief. It's turn for mic number three.
You spoke about pursuing justice, equal, right? We're supposed to be showing both sides of the argument. However, I'm afraid that law of the speech tonight seems to be only showing one side. You seem to be equivocating Hamas and the Israeli government. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. You seem to be equivocating Hamas and the Israeli government. Is it not true that the State Department recognizes Hamas as a terrorist organization while Israel is considered one of America's greatest allies in the Middle East? And further upon that point, Hamas in its charter calls in nearly every clause for the destruction of the state of Israel. Israel, who you seem to be saying, is not pursuing the two-state solution. I'd like to remind you that in 1948, with the partition plan that was offered by the United Nations, who was the one who accepted it? Was it not Israel accepted the limited lands?
Thank you. Can we go to mic number four?
It's going to be very hard for me to remember.
Professor, we're
going to
take three questions at a time. Number four.
Just stay there, so if I forget it, you'll prompt me.
Yes. Number four.
The United Nations Charter guarantees the right of resisting the occupying force or colonizing force or whatever. But at the same time, Hamas went in the path of terrorism and targeting civilians. Where could we draw the line and distinguish between legitimate resistance of the occupation and the terrorism in the context of Israel and Palestine? Because it's very intertwined, civilians with army.
Thank you.
I would like to have you elaborate on that. Thank you.
Can we get mic number one, please?
You talked about anti-Semitism as a non-existing concept
no,
in our day.
No, I said the claim no, my, of a new anti-Semitism.
But you said in Europe it's in decline. No, in Europe you...
The Pew Charitable Trusts.
And you have quoted him that anti-Semitism is in decline in Europe.
Correct.
Okay. Then my question is, my synagogue in Istanbul was bombed a year ago. And what is so not anti-Semitic about that? And how does that correlate with the decline of anti-Semitism? Thank you.
Okay. There are three questions. I'm going to try to be fair, but honestly, my mind just can't absorb so many questions. And you had three. I'll focus on one. The question of Hamas's charter. And I said, I agree, there's no question that they have made statements and there are documents of theirs which call for the destruction of Israel. That's unambiguous and rational people will not dispute it. However, I said two other things. Number one, no Israeli government, political party, or official has recognized the reciprocal right of Palestinians to a state within the internationally authorized borders. And number two, I said that morally, there is a world of difference. A chasm separates a document which calls for the destruction and the daily actions of a state which are practicing the destruction. That's a very different thing. And what Israel is now doing is, in practice, destroying the Palestinian state.
Excuse me.
On the question of the right of resistance, There's no right of resistance in the United Nations Charter. There have been resolutions or a resolution passed, if my memory serves, December 9th or 7th, 1987, speaking about a right to resist colonial and racist occupation. That's the only resolution I'm familiar with in the United Nations corpus on the topic. How do you determine what is and what isn't legitimate resistance and what is and is not targeting civilians? Once again, I do not want to play the role of arbiter. And in fact, I fully acknowledge not being an authority on international law. What I do as a layperson, I look at the human rights reports. I look at the standard they use. And they have a standard of non-combatants, civilians, and bystanders. And I use that standard and their findings to report what's going on. And I have to insist most emphatically that at least among human rights organizations, there is no quarrel or dissent on these issues. They are pretty straightforward. On the third question, number one, as a technicality, Turkey is not part of Europe.
How about the situation in France?
I'm sorry, we are not allowed to follow us for anyone.
When there is reference to the new anti-Semitism, it's very clear who they're referring to. Because if you read the reports, as I have, and maybe you have also, there's the European Monitoring Group on Racism, Anti-Semitism. They're called the Raxin Reports. And they two large ones came out. And they go through country by country by country of all the member states. Turkey is not included. Now, that's a technical question. You may say to me, well, that's evading the issue. It's not evading the issue. Because the question is not whether there is anti-Semitism in the Arab world. Everybody knows there is. That's not a problem area. What the claim of a new anti-Semitism is, they claim, and now I'm quoting, they're claiming Amnesty International is anti-Semitic. Human Rights Watch is anti-Semitic. CNN is anti-Semitic. Los Angeles Times is anti-Semitic. Washington Post is anti-Semitic. The Guardian is anti-Semitic. Read Phyllis Chesler. All Jewish feminists are anti-Semitic. That's what they call the new anti-Semitism. And I say that claim falls somewhere in that spectrum which we identified earlier of between lunacy and crackpottery.
We have to evacuate the room quickly, but I will take one quick round of questions on the condition that everyone leaves very quickly after we're done. Okay? Mic number two.
Okay. Just hang on. Hello. Yes. Firstly, what I have to say is more of an observation rather than an actual question.
You have to make it very quick.
Yes, it is very quick, and as I was just about to say, it'll end up saving you a lot of time. First off, I'd like to congratulate you on the lecture. It was truly excellent. However, there was something rather significant to the history of this conflict that I actually felt you missed out. And in doing so, perhaps didn't do this lecture the complete justice it could have been done. Namely, the bombing of the King David Hotel and the destruction of lives at the hands of the Stern Gang, many of whose members, criminals, I don't think would be too severe a term to use, have occupied and are occupying positions of respect in the Israeli government and power. And at the same time, how on earth can Israel expect to be taken seriously on issues of terrorism when it so systematically fails to come to terms with its own terrorist past? That's all I have to say. Thank you.
One final question from mic number three.
Okay. I'll just say the King David Hotel was a British military installation, but I wanted to say two things. You're hanging your hat on the UN and the human rights reports. You appear to have missed Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International's press releases, both of which have said that the most important resolution on the conflict is 242. And 242 does not call for Israel to withdraw to 67 borders, and I'm sure you know that as a scholar of the conflict. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you've cited a Pew Research poll to prove that anti-Semitism in Europe is on the decline. I would cite incident reports from, particularly from France and from England, that show the exact opposite. We saw it again. We saw it again last week with the torture and the murder of Ilan Halimi, and with several. Forget about bombing. We heard about the bombing of a synagogue in Istanbul. There have been several firebombings of synagogues in France, firebombings of school buses of Jewish children. So how you can claim that anti-Semitism is actually on the wane in these countries, citing what appears to be a public opinion poll, I think that's a little bit like your citation that there's a right of
Thank
refugees
you.
That controls in the conflict. I think that's selective, to say
much.
The least. My question is that Israel and Hamas are not equal because Hamas doesn't have the means to do what Israel does. Hamas has tried several times to perpetrate mega-terror attacks at places like the Azrael
You are not, unfortunately, getting to a question. We will have to move on to one last question.
If one of those terrorist attacks actually happened and thousands of people were killed, would you still come back here and tell us that the casualty rates are similar?
Thank you very much. Quote mic number four. Very briefly, please. He will answer it in a second. Very briefly, please.
Hi, and I'll be quick, yes. I agree with most of what you said tonight, but I have a simple problem with what you say, that if everything is so simple and if everyone agrees about it, then how come, are we then to believe that every American administration from the creation of Israel and every other Western administration is falling in line, like the Communist Party of Enver Hoxha in Albania, in supporting willingly and knowingly Israel by the simple fact of doing business with it? Like, is this something that you're asking us to believe? I just have
Thank
a problem
you.
With it.
I'm afraid this will have to be the last question, Professor Finkelstein.
Okay. On the very last question, there is a consensus, but the U.S. falls outside the consensus. And the U.S. is very powerful. And I think it comes as no surprise to people in this room if I tell them that the U.S., because of its opposition, is able to deadlock the peace process. That's not a shock. It happens on many fronts in the world today where the U.S. is politically isolated, but nonetheless has the power to block the will of the planet, so to speak. On the question I was asked, the second question, well, there were two aspects to it. One was, what if Hamas did this and what if Hamas did that? And most of you know the famous what if grandma had wheels, would she be a baby carriage? I can't deal with what ifs. I can only deal with what was and what is.
Excuse me. We would appreciate your silence, please, at this moment.
And on the basis of on the basis of...
You had your time for your question. I'm sorry. Professor Finkelstein, please go ahead.
On the basis of what was and what is, the record of Israel is much worse. On the question of UN Resolution 242, you say, as a scholar, I have to know that it doesn't call for a full Israeli withdrawal. And I agree that I'm not going to claim to authority on the topic, although I have written extensively on it and examined the record. What I'll do is how I began this evening. I said the World Court, the highest judicial body in the world, it ruled in its advisory opinion on that question, and it stated, quote, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. That's anchored in Article 2 of the United Nations Charter. The whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, and East Jerusalem are designated for Palestinian self-determination, they constitute occupied Palestinian territory. I can't change that. That's what the World Court said. And as to the first question, basically I agree. Good night.
Thank you very much, Professor Finkelstein. On behalf of all the organizers, we thank everyone for coming here and for being in this excellent event. We hope we will see you again in many of the events of the organizers. Thank you very much.